Just we're going to start in 2 minutes on a day like we have today. I got stuck on the way here. I needed two nice people. I got stuck in front of the shtievel in our neighborhood, which is a good place to get stuck, because a few people on their way to Minyan came out and they gave me a push, and that's how I got here. Otherwise, who knows where I'd be now. Anyway, just before we start, I just got to make a couple of announcements. Just I always reiterate, but it's really quite an amazing experience. For those who have yet to take one of our courses online, we have, you know, 8 courses going on now online, 8 hours a week. So it's definitely going to be a time which is convenient. I would urge everybody to try one of these online courses. It's completely interactive. You see the speaker. It's free. Yes, it is free. You see the speaker, you hear the speaker, you can talk to the speaker, you can write to the speaker. So I encourage anybody who would like to try one of those to try. The blue flyers are outside, classes are ongoing, and it's well worth your while. Also, our retreat, which we have a few people who were there last year who are sitting in the room, it was very beautiful last year. We're having our second retreat on the 22nd and 23rd of February at the Sheraton Hotel. It's a beautiful hotel by the airport. You don't even know you're in the airport when you're there. It's a really beautiful hotel. And Rabbi Heshy and Rookie Billet from Long Island are going to be our guest speakers. They are wonderful speakers. Be looking forward to a wonderful weekend. So yeah. If anybody would like to join us, the early bird special expired on Friday. But of the kindness of our heart and the hotel allowing us, we'll take the early bird special until Wednesday to pay. Anyway, without further ado, Ellie's going to introduce you.
Yeah. I don't know, I suppose. Yeah, I'm going to introduce myself. Do you want to? I have a thing? I don't have it here.
Good morning. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce to you Dr. Ada Rappaport-Albert. Professor Albert received her PhD in Jewish history from University College London, which is where she's been associated for many years. She's now a reader, what we'd call an associate professor in Jewish history, and head of the Department of Hebrew and Jewish Studies there. She's taught at Oxford University's Oriental Institute and held a variety of visiting professorships at Stanford, Harvard, Penn, and other places. And as the past president of the British Association for Jewish Studies, she's done an enormous amount of scholarly work in the areas of Hasidut, Sabbatianism, Kabbalah. Is now involved in a major collaborative project on the Aramaic language of the Zohar, and is publishing several books presently on these topics. Those of you who were here last night heard her and understand that she's a remarkably articulate and passionate expositor of the themes of this conference. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Ada Rappaport-Albert.
Those of you who were here last night might remember that I referred to an article I published almost 20 years ago in which I tried to show that the Hasidic movement certainly from the beginning in the second half of the 18th century and as far as I can see during the whole of the 19th century was essentially a men's affair. Women were very, very peripheral to it. I think that at the very beginning, when the first small clusters of Hasidim were gathering around the early founders, the founding fathers of Hasidism, the first generation of the leadership of Hasidism, women were out of the picture altogether. We have evidence from some of the Mitnagdim, as well as some internal Hasidic evidence, to suggest that men would actually abandon their wives. Usually the recruits to Hasidism in the first generations were young men in the early years of marriage, usually with one or two children at home, usually from the class of the scholars, not as one commonly portrays Hasidism as a mass movement of popular, uneducated, simple people, but Hasidism appealed to the scholarly elite, young men dropping out of family life and spending periods ranging from a few weeks, sometimes to a whole a year or several months, at the court of their charismatic leader, of their Rebbe, and forming a community that is entirely male, which in a sense symbolically reproduces many of the rituals of family life. It is a substitute for family life, very emotionally charged, love being the relationship between the Rebbe and his Hasidim. Bear it in mind that the Hasidic gathering, the highlight of Hasidic gathering, is at a table during the third Sabbath meal, namely family institutions being reproduced collectively by this community, women-free community of early Hasidim. Eventually, into the 19th century, there's no doubt that Hasidism becomes something into which one is born rather than something that one joins, sometimes as a result of a split with one's family. arousing opposition from one's in-laws or from parents. Once it becomes established as a hereditary association with a particular Hasidic dynasty or another, women are associated with it. And we know from the hagiographic of literature of Hasidism, namely from the literature of the tales about the lives of the great Hasidic masters, that women did sometimes come to the court, seek the Rebbe for a blessing, gave their pidyon. Some Hasidic courts did allow them in, others didn't. But on the whole, they continued to be excluded from those highlights of the gathering where the Hasidim heard the Torah, the teaching of their Rebbe, and remained very, very peripheral to the whole thing. It is not until the early 20th century when the entire Orthodox sector, not just the Hasidim, Hasidim and Mitnagdim alike, suddenly woke up to the fact that half of their constituency has been dormant, and they're beginning to appeal to their female constituency, trying to harness them in the campaign against various secularist ideology, against socialism and Zionism and Haskalah. They realize that the women who actually control the education of the children, who control the degree of kosherness in the house, who can have a lot of influence on the future generation, are the people that they should be appealing to. And so we have some Hasidic leaders, some non-Hasidic leaders, for the first time in the early decades of the 20th century, beginning to appeal to women, to have a certain message for women. But up until then, Hasidism, I really believe, has no message for women at all. And I shall return to this later on in another context. I want to, by way of introduction, to say only one more thing, and that is that more recently, long after writing this piece about women, the position of women in Hasidism, I did some work, which is due to come out in English early next calendar year, about the position of women in the Sabbatean heresy, Sabbatean and Frankist heresy, where the evidence is astounding, where women, in sharp contrast, are very central to the messianic project of the heretics. Uniquely, I believe, in the Jewish tradition, since antiquity, and I exclude from the discussion biblical and Hellenistic Judaism, which I believe where gender issues operate in a completely different way. But in what we call rabbinic Judaism, from the early decades of the Common Era, the system that basically still governs Jewish life to this day, I believe that uniquely the Sabbatean movement promoted women to the fore, recognized them as prophetesses. You have hundreds, if not thousands, of women who are prophesying, some of them becoming leaders of sectarian communities of their own. And perhaps the climax of this phenomenon is the promotion of a woman, a holy virgin. I mean, it's a very syncretistic phenomenon. There are certain Christian influences, there are certain Muslim influences, but you have a cult around a woman, Eva Frank, the daughter of Jacob Frank, who is the messianic figurehead for her father's followers. She is the Messiah, and her father, Jacob Frank, actually tells his followers, and we have his dicta, his statements preserved in a very large collection, The Words of the Lord, as it is called, survived in Polish only, in which he tells his followers the only reason why all previous messianic projects had failed, right from Adam, who was the first potential Messiah, through David, Moses, every other historical candidate we have for messiahship, they all failed for one reason only, that they were men. Because the Messiah's soul, according to Kabbalistic tradition, is derived from the Sfira Malchut, from the 10th Sfira, the female Sfira of the Kabbalistic conception of the Godhead. And therefore, when the Messiah manifests himself as a human being, when it is the Sfira Malchut incarnate, as he says, she has to manifest herself in a woman. And that is why all previous messianic projects, including Sabbatai Tzvi's, had failed. So remarkable things in the Sabbatean movement. And I'm going to refer to this as a point of contrast with what happens in Hasidism. And I really do believe that the reason why Hasidism really excludes women very, very consistently is not just that it is conforming to a Jewish tradition in which women are very peripheral to the spiritual and intellectual life of the community. They have other roles. You know, there's a very strict division of roles. So it's not just that Hasidism is being perfectly traditional and is doing exactly what other Eastern European Jewish communities, non-Hasidic communities, are doing with their women. But I believe now, which I didn't know when I first began to work on the position of women in Hasidism, that there is in Hasidism's exclusion of women a certain degree of reaction against the Sabbatean precedent. They were very aware of what the Sabbateans were doing, with women in particular. And I think because Sabbateanism was discredited completely, was associated above all with the breakdown of the traditional halachic constraints on sexual relations. It was associated with all kinds of licentious conduct, the breakdown of Issurei Arayot. Because of that, Hasidism really was retreating with horror from the promotion of women in Sabbateanism and excluded women in the way in which they might not have done quite so much if not for the bitter experience of the Sabbatean crisis. And I shall say later on why I think Hasidism might have included women and really didn't, not until the 20th century. Now, Chabad. Against this background of Hasidism generally, I think Chabad doesn't have a particularly distinguished historical record at all. Chabad behaves like all other Hasidic communities from the beginning. About the founder of Chabad, Reb Shneur Zalman of Lodi, I think there's good reason. We haven't got explicit evidence about what he thought should be done with women, should they be included or excluded. There is no direct evidence. But one can surmise from silence that women were simply not a part of the enterprise at all. We have, as I mentioned, I think, already last night, we have the ordinances of Lyozhna, the set of rules that he issued in the 1790s when he was resident in the town of Lyozhna before he moved to Lyadi, which is the name of the town by which he eventually became known, in which you can see he's trying to regulate the flow of the pilgrims that come to his court to see him, to hear his Torah, to get his blessing. And he tries to impose restrictions on different classes of Hasidim. So there is a map of different types of Hasidim that he draws. Women are never mentioned there at all. Moreover, I feel that Reb Shneur Zalman of Lodi, like his contemporary Nachman of Braslav, was one of the Hasidic leaders who were very eager to distance themselves from a certain type of Hasidic leadership that they dismissed as popular, vulgar. Nachman of Braslav is much more explicit in his denunciation of many of his contemporaries as ignorant Hasidim, tzaddikim, righteous leaders who have no Torah of their own. All they do is they perform miracles. Miracles are cheap, he says. Anyone can perform a miracle. That's not what defines a Hasidic leader. Hasidic leader has to have a Torah, a teaching, which is morally and spiritually challenging. That's what I give to my Hasidim. Shneur Zalman is one of these Hasidic leaders, very dismissive of the type of Hasidism that consists of nothing other than the Hasidim coming to the Rebbe for his blessing over practical material affairs of daily life, parnasa, marriage, children. He really wants his Hasidim not to turn to him with such questions. He says, come to me with your spiritual dilemmas. That's what I'm here for. And because women had no access to the Torah, all they could come and seek was the blessing of the Rebbe and the expectation of miraculous feats, you know, so barren women would have children, or women who miscarry would stop miscarrying, or problems of parnasa would be resolved. If that was all that they could expect, then I don't think Shneur Zalman encouraged it. Now, we do have quite a lot of late 20th century hagiographical traditions, part of this tradition of telling stories about the lives of the great Hasidic leaders, that do tell us explicitly that Shneur Zalman of Lodi did not accept women. Now, these stories are anthologies of Chabad tales that begin to be written really only in the middle of the 20th century and are published in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, even more recently. Normally, I would be extremely suspicious of them. You know, I have worked with this type of literature and have tried to show that it has its role, but it has very little to do with actual historical events. You know, it serves another function. But in this case, I have used as a methodological yardstick the following principle. If the tale has a message which runs counter to what 20th century Chabad ended up advocating, and as I've already intimated, 20th century Chabad does have a message for women, is interested in mobilizing women, and in the activities of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, actually revolutionizes the status of women in the movement. So if the tale goes against that and tells us that Shneur Zalman of Lodi and his successors did not have anything to do with women, I am more prepared to believe it. If it was telling us the opposite, if it was projecting onto the past the ideology of the present, then I would have been very suspicious of it. So as it is, I take seriously these traditions, which quite consistently tell me Reb Shneur Zalman had little to do with women. He would not allow women to come to the court at all. And I've collected, although I don't have time to read them to you, a rich assembly of tales that effectively tell me the same about each one of the Chabad leaders, from the Alter Rebbe, from the founder of Chabad, through the Mittler Rebbe, his son, through the Tzemach Tzedek, his son-in-law. The Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, you know, in the middle of the 19th century, is a particularly interesting case because he has a reputation of being particularly attentive to the problems of desperate women, above all, agunot. He has a reputation, he was a halachist. He published, the Tzemach Tzedek, his nickname, is the title of his collection of responsa. He had the reputation of being particularly concerned to alleviate the lot of desperate agunot, women who are deserted by their husbands, or women who are chasing after yabam, you know, women who need to get released from a marriage, a levirate marriage, in order to marry somebody else, women in trouble altogether. That reputation, I tried to check. I looked at the Tzemach Tzedek, the collection of his responsa, and it is indeed true. In volume one, they were published long after his death, but there's no doubt of their authenticity. The two volumes of his responsa, in volume one, in Eben HaEzer, there's a huge section of about 80 tshuvot responsa that deal with agunot, and in the majority of cases, you can see that he goes out of his way to solve the problem to the advantage of the woman, to make it easier for the woman to be released. So there is a clear, consistent tendency to help women. So the reputation that he was particularly attentive to the plight of agunot and other desperate women is well-grounded historically. So one would expect, perhaps, to see that he was more open to women visiting the court, telling him his problems. Nevertheless, the hagiographical tales almost consistently tell us, with the Rebbe Mendele, I'm now quoting from memory, but almost verbatim, women were never allowed to set a foot in the court. There is one tradition that tells us that he changed his conduct halfway through his period of leadership under the influence of his wife. There's a tale that claims that once his wife became very ill, he came to visit her in her room, and he sat at her bedside, and she told him, she reproached him, Mendel, I am ill because of you. And he says, why? What have I done? She said, because you turn away all the desperate women who turn to you, who come to you for help, and you don't let them come in. And from that time on, says this tale, this particular tale, which was published in the 1960s, from that time on, he allowed women to come, and he kept them in an adjacent room to his own room. They stood behind the door. He wouldn't look at them, but he would listen to their story from behind the closed door, and he would give them their advice, and they would be able to hear what he said. And miraculously, time and again, the husband who had been missing or, you know, reputed to be dead was found. The matter was resolved. You know, I don't know whether this is true, but it confirms the impression that this was a problematic area. Women normally were not allowed, not even to the court of the Tzemach Tzedek, who had this particular reputation of concern for women. The same goes on right through the 19th century. And the first change is detected at the turn of the 20th century. And I shall give you a more detailed account of that in a minute. But I wanted to pause for a moment and explain why I believe, because this will become important for what I would like to say about the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, why it is that I believe that this attitude of really keeping women at a distance, allowing them very little access to the Rebbe, to the life of the court, why I think that it is such a striking near miss, you know, why I believe that Hasidism had the potentiality to actually incorporate women fully and actively in its own spiritual revival enterprise. And that is because if you try to define what Hasidism is all about while standing on one leg, if you're trying to really extract the essence of Hasidic spirituality, it is the idea that the world is filled with God, that God is not somewhere transcendent above, but rather that he is down here amongst us. And if we can't always see it, then the whole point of the exercise is to draw down holiness, to draw down divinity, to draw down, using the language of the Kabbalah, the particles of divine light, the nitzotzot, to draw divinity down onto the mundane material world that we occupy. In other words, to sanctify the mundane, to make that which is physical, corporeal, material, spiritual, to expose the spiritual core that animates everything, even the most base manifestation of creation in material existence. I believe that this is the essence of Hasidism. Now, if that is the essence of the Hasidic doctrine, then bear it in mind that women traditionally, I believe as far back as the classical rabbinic sources, although in the classical rabbinic sources, in the Talmud, in the Midrashim, this is not yet stated explicitly. Certainly by the Middle Ages, when the influence of Greek philosophical categories of thought is very transparent in the literature of Judaism, you begin to get this very clear dualism of body and soul with its concomitant association of woman with body and man with soul. This becomes almost a cliche of medieval Jewish literature. You find it in philosophical literature, in Kabbalistic literature. Woman is body, woman is matter, as opposed to man, who is form or soul or sometimes intellect. And this is very, very commonplace in the literature. And I really believe that the perception is already embedded in classical rabbinic sources, though it's not yet articulated in those terms. So it's a very fundamental perception of the female nature. The complementarity of the two goes without saying. The two are legitimate and fine, and they should come together, and that will be perfect humanity. But the division is very clear. Now, if women represent the material, the physical pole of existence, then Hasidism just begs to exploit that. Let us use women. They could even be the vanguard of the project of converting the corporeal, the material, into the spiritual. Women, better than anything else, embody the physical, the corporeal, and the material, which has within it the capacity of being transformed into spirituality. So to exclude women strikes me as very perverse. I also have noted and would like to share with you an even odder phenomenon, and that is that the idea that women, because they are essentially material, physical, corporeal, are capable of being transformed into pure spirituality, you find this idea in Hasidic literature. This is an idea that the Hasidic masters play with quite a lot. Most famously, there's a teaching by the Maggid of Mezrich, the second great leader of Hasidism, which goes more or less as follows. If you are in the process of trying to meditate, to focus your mind on nothing but God, and suddenly you are being distracted by an erotic thought, by the image of a beautiful woman that you had seen in the street inadvertently earlier on. And as we know, erotic thoughts are quite distracting. And suddenly all your attempts to focus your mind on nothing but God are breaking down because this idea, this image of the beautiful, the sexually attractive woman infiltrates your mind and stops you from your meditation of God. What do? He says, Kabbalists in the past used to train themselves to deal with such distractions by pushing them out, banishing them. How do you train your mind to do that? You do it by attacking your body. You adopt a very ascetic way of life. You diminish your bodily needs. You fast. You have very little sexual relations, the minimum that the halakha would permit you to get away with. You tame your body to need much less. And that enables you to cope much better with the seduction of erotic fantasies that would be completely meaningless to you if your body has been trained to fight them away. That was the traditional Kabbalistic practice, and that is why many Kabbalists indeed adopted a very ascetic way of life that contained quite extreme measures sometimes of self-mortification, long periods of sexual abstinence, all in order to train the body to resist distractions of the mind. The Maggid of Mezrich says, no, what you should do is embrace this image of the sexually attractive woman. Don't push it out of your consciousness. Go along with it. Follow it through and think, where does the beauty of this woman originate? It originates in the source of all beauty, which is up there, which is divine. Think of her physical sexual appeal as her external garb, This is her exterior manifestation, and you can peel it off, because that external manifestation of her physical beauty is transient. And the Maggid actually says, think of her when she's an old woman. Think of her when she's dead, he says. Surely she will be repulsive then. Her physical beauty would become a repulsive thing. Nothing would be left of it. What is permanent and eternal in her is the inner beauty, which is the divine in her. And so the erotic thought, if you follow it through, and if you strip it of its outer shells and penetrate its inner core, actually becomes an opportunity for an encounter with God. It actually enhances your endeavor to focus on nothing but God. So this is the teaching. The Maggid of Mezrich offers it in more than one of his statements. His disciples repeat it. It's quite common in Hasidic literature. And this is exactly the point. The woman who is physical is essentially spiritual, because she is a manifestation of the divine, like everything else in creation. And in your mind, you can transform her into nothing but divine energy, pure spirituality. So the idea is there, but bear it in mind that it is there in the contemplative minds of men. The woman who was actually spotted on the street inadvertently earlier on in the day, and that had triggered this erotic fantasy, is oblivious of the whole exercise, is not a party to it, is not herself able to undergo this kind of meditative exercise that would convert her into a purely spiritual being. The Maggid is talking to nothing but a community of men. The women are not present, they're not addressed. So the idea is there, but it is diverted into a contemplative technique for men only. And so I have a feeling that there is a kind of a missed opportunity. Hasidism could so easily have incorporated women. It chooses not to. And my suspicion is that it is the experience of Sabbateanism and what happens to women in Sabbateanism that encourages it to keep women out of the way. Because once you unleash the spiritual powers of women, once you have women prophesying at every street corner, inevitably, that was the perception, you begin to get the breakdown of family relations. Women sleep with everybody, as the Sabbateans did. There's incest, there is complete breakdown of morality. Stay away from it. Okay, now back to Chabad and what happens there at the beginning of the 20th century. As I suggested to you, my feeling is that women up until this point are very peripheral to the whole enterprise, although they probably belong by virtue of family tradition, by virtue of their husbands, their brothers, their fathers, being regular visitors to one Hasidic court or another. I even have one tradition that strengthens my impression that the female Hasidic identity at that time, this is in the 19th century, at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, from one of these late hagiographical traditions that I choose to take seriously because they run counter to the subsequent ideology, dominant ideology of Chabad. And this is a story about the mother of the fifth Admor Shalom Dov Be'er, the Admor Shalom Dov Be'er. This is the Revitin Rivka. She's quite a striking character. Her grandson, the sixth Admor, Yosef Yitzchak, has written a lot about her. She's the source of many of the stories that he tells about early history of Hasidism, the early history of Chabad. She's a very powerful woman. There are traditions that say that she conducted herself as a rebbe, she held a tish, she certainly gave brachot, a very powerful spiritual woman. Now, when she was an old woman, a widow, living like the Dowager Rebbetzin at her son's court, she one day, this is dated 1910, and in fact it is presented not as a story, but as a piece of memoir by the author. And from the point of view of the chronology, it is perfectly possible. He remembers. He was a young man. This is the celebration of Simchat Torah in Lubavitch in 1910. The Hasidim gathered with the Admor, Shalom Dov Be'er, in the Zal of the Yeshiva, in the hall of the Yeshiva, which was quite stuffy. It was very, very crowded. And the Admor was addressing his followers, but at a certain point it became clear to everybody that he was extremely unwell. He could barely stand, he was sweating heavily, he was very unwell. So the Rebbetzin Rivka was summoned, and she kind of walked in the middle of the room with all the men, all the disciples there, grabbed her son and said, "You must stop. Stop now, you can say what you have to say later on." And he refuses. He says, Mother, I can't do that. I am a Hasidic Rebbe. I have to finish the sticha. You know that in Chabad there are two levels of delivery of teaching by the Rebbe. There's the sticha, the talk, technically the red, which is the less formal mode of delivery. And then there's the ma'amal, the really serious sermon. And he says to her, I need to finish this sticha that I'm in the middle of, and then I still have to give a ma'amal. And Chabad ma'amarim are very long. They could go on for about 4 hours. The woman, the mother, is having none of it. She says, no, you can't, in your condition, you can't go. You must stop. She insists. And so he turns to her and says, Mame du bist doch a chassidische Yidene. Mother, you are a female chassid. Let me get on with it. Surely you must understand that this is what I need to do. And she replies, Zu bin ich a chassidische Yidene, weiß ich nicht. Aber von chassidim stamm ich avade. She says, whether I am a female chassid or not, I don't know. And this is a kind of a sarcastic way of saying, leave me alone with this. I'm not a chassidic, I'm not a chassid. That what I am sure about is that I am of Hasidic descent. I come from the Geza, I come from Hasidic descent, which for me defines the female consciousness of the Hasidah. You know, she descends from. But she's not actively involved. She doesn't care about his ma'amal, she doesn't care about his sikha. She wants him to maintain himself in good health. And she defines her affiliation to Hasidism. And this is from the most prominent center of a Hasidic group. She's not just an ordinary wife of Hasid. She is the Dowager Rebbetzin. For her, Hasidism means being from Hasidic descent. And I think this is where it stands at the point at which I detect the first signs of change. Because her daughter-in-law, Shtena Sara, the wife of the Admor Shalom Dovber, is the first leader, female, the first wife of a Hasidic leader who I begin to see is stirring some kind of activity amongst the female members of the Chabad community of her day. Up until then, although it is true that women occasionally did come to the court, and there's even, I don't have time to go into it, but there are quite a lot of tales that suggest, and this is perfectly plausible, that whereas women had no access to the Rebbe himself, they could sometimes come to the court and have a private audience with the wife of the Rebbe, or with the daughter-in-law of the Rebbe, or with the daughter, whoever, one of the prominent women in the household. And the woman who is the wife or the daughter-in-law of the Rebbe would serve as an intermediary. She would communicate the request, the problem of the woman who had come to her, to the Rebbe, and come back with an answer. Quite a lot of tales suggest that. Whether it is historically true or not, we can't tell, but it is perfectly plausible. The point, however, is, and I've asked myself when I first came across these tales, does that suggest that even though the woman's association with the court is very secondary, because she's excluded from the Torah, from all, nevertheless, there is a constituency here. All these women come to the court, they consult the wife or the daughter-in-law of the Rebbe, they convey their message to the Rebbe. Perhaps one can speak of a female constituency. But one must remember that in contrast to the male Hasidim, who come not just as individuals to seek a yechidut, a private audience with the Rebbe, and to get his advice and his blessing, but they also come collectively as a group at regular times. They assemble, they are spiritually empowered as a collective, and that creates a constituency. A bunch of individuals coming at odd times as ad hoc, on an ad hoc basis, when the need arises, doesn't yet form a constituency. The women always come on their own, not at regular times. If there's a problem, she makes an effort, she can afford it, she comes and talks to the Rebbetzin or to the daughter-in-law. So it's a very different type of constituency. If one can think of it as a constituency at all, then it is very, very tenuous. With Shtena Sara, in the early decades of the 20th century, while the court is still in Lubavitch, and you know that the court moved from Lubavitch during the First World War. It moved eventually, it settled at Rostov on the Don, but the kind of the headquarters of the Chabad movement throughout the 19th century lasted until the First World War, when eventually it simply evacuated the town of Lubavitch because it became too close to the front. The German army was approaching and they were afraid that they would be invaded by the Germans. So in the first two decades of the 20th century, around the Rebbetzin Shtena Sara, I found interesting stories that suggest the beginning of some kind of a female collective emerging. One indication, a story about a burglary that occurred. And again, this is not a tale, but it occurs in the memoirs of a chosid who was there, claims to have been there, and I have no reason to doubt it. I think this is before 1910, the Admor and his family, during the summer, used to go to rent a dacha, you know, as Russians do, a summer house, not far from the town of Lubavitch. And they would move there for the summer months. During the time when they were staying there, in a small place in Belarus, called Benovichi, I think, there was a burglary. Some burglars came during the night and took some precious objects, and the Rebbetzin woke up and was terrified. And there's news of this reached the town of Lubavitch, where the yeshiva that the Admor Shalom Dovber had founded in 1897, Tomchei Tmimim. So there was a whole cluster of yeshiva students there, the yeshiva teachers there. When the news reached the town of Lubavitch, all of them en masse went to this little summer town, summer village where the house was to support the Rebbe, to see what had happened. And there's a comment, and all the women of the town of Lubavitch, described as hamekoravot, those who were particularly close, came to see, to be with the Rebbetzin. So there is already a nucleus of women, permanent residents of the town of Lubavitch, where the Lubavitch court is, who are defined as mekoravot. I don't know exactly what is meant by that. But it stands to reason that physical proximity made it possible for them to maintain regular personal contact with the Rebbetzin, and they are considered a kind of an entourage. Nor do I know how many of them there were. But there's a group, and they're acting as a group. They're all coming together as a group. Much more interestingly... Is that the kitchen stuff? Okay, sorry. Much more interestingly and more tellingly, we have a few years later, 1911-1912, the Rebbetzin Sterna Sarah comes up with what, as far as I can see, is the first initiative of its kind. She sends an appeal to all the women of Chabad for the first time, not just the Mekoravot of the town of Lubavitch, but to the wider Chabad community, which by that time is spread all over the Russian Empire, which at this time is very large. It includes places which eventually become independent states. And she seeks donations from the women in order to enable her to set up a kitchen in Lubavitch and a dining room for the junior students of the yeshiva. The senior students already had one, because the Admor Shalom Dovber had a vision. He wanted the students to live in the yeshiva and to eat in the yeshiva, which was quite unusual. At Volozhin, for example, they ate and slept in the traditional way in the houses of Balei Batim in the town. This was the first, apparently, initiative, and I'm saying that on the basis of the doctoral dissertation of a student of mine who wrote a history of the yeshiva Tomchei Tmimim. It appeared that this is the first such initiative on pedagogic ground, to get all the students to live together, eat together, sleep together, to forge a collective spirit better, rather than allow them to be supported by rotation by householders in the town. So the senior students are already catered for, but the young students who had not yet entered the higher levels of the yeshiva are still staying, renting rooms all over the town. She took it upon herself to find the money to establish a dining room and a kitchen that would produce meals for the youngsters as well. And we know about this because she published. She published the accounts of this project. She founded what she calls the Women's Association in Support of the Poor Junior Yeshiva Students of Lubavitch. And she published a kol kore, an appeal, sent it out all over the place, and managed to collect 179 donations. And she published them in a little booklet, published in St. Petersburg in 1912, in which all the donors, and they're all women, are listed by name, and the amount that they gave, and the town from which they came. Her son, the Admor Yosef Yitzchak, writes about her in a kind of an obituary notice, which is published in the journal HaKriava HaKadusha that he founded in the United States after they moved there. She died in 1942 in New York. She came out with him. So in the first issue of HaKriava HaKadusha after her death, he has an obituary notice which from then on is published in every issue. And he says of her, because that fits his ideology, the Rebbetzin founded a worldwide women's organization in support of the yeshiva students of Chabad. Now, this is an exaggeration, because we have 179 contributions. We can tell where they came from. There was one from New York. There was one from Königsberg, which at that time is still part of the Russian Empire anyway. one from Grossvaldein, which is in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and I think one from somewhere in Finland, Jakobstadt in Finland. But all the rest are from various corners of the Russian Empire. So it's not an international women's organization, but it is a widespread selection. Women who are not connected to one another, unlike the Makarovot, that intimate circle in Lubavitch itself, now she's appealing to women who are as far apart from each other, Moscow, St. Petersburg, lots of places in the Ukraine, all over. They're sending donations to her. They become members of this association. And we have what I believe is the first emergence of a Chabad female constituency with the Rebbetzin as its figurehead. There's also some indication that this Rebbetzin, Shtena Sara in particular, was quite involved in public affairs, something that we don't hear about the earlier Rebbetzins. We certainly don't have such news about the wife of Shneur Zalman, the wife of the Mittler Rebbe. They were perhaps influential within the family circle, the immediate family circle, but they don't exert influence widely in the public affairs of the Chabad community. She is, I believe, co-opted into what I'm tempted to call the senior management team of her day, which is actually embarked on the process of modernizing Chabad at the turn of the 20th century. She becomes the woman in charge of women affairs because they have woken up to the female constituency that can be harnessed to the project. Alongside her son, the Admor Yosef Yitzchak, and her husband, who are operating together around the yeshiva, which is a thoroughly modern institution that they have founded, Tomchei Tminim. Now, a generation later, at the time when her son takes over in 1920, and begins to run things in his extremely effective and modern style, we have the first appeals to women that go beyond just mobilizing them to donate money for the purpose of encouraging young men to become trained in the Chabad spirit at the yeshiva. Bear it in mind that Shalom Dov Ber is not appealing to women in order to build a kind of a Hasidic consciousness amongst them, in order to train them in Hasidic teachings at all. He is calling on them, through his wife, to give money for the support of the young men. He envisaged the most promising way of combating secularism, which was his mission. You know, he fought Haskalah, he fought Zionism. He thought the solution was to establish a yeshiva, to train an army, and he uses this militaristic language, an army of young men, the Tmimim, the students of the yeshiva, who would be so imbued in the values of Chabad and of Orthodox Judaism that they would be the vanguard. They would then fight against these modern phenomena that he felt threatened the Jewish world. He has no message to women along that side. He even, in a very famous sikha that I've quoted and published elsewhere, he tells his audience in a sikha that women are the root of the problem. He diagnoses the origins of what he calls the filth of secularism in women. Women are the ones who brought it into the home. Because, and this has a certain historical justification, because as you know, in Eastern Europe, women had very little access to Jewish education. On the other hand, they were very intensely involved in livelihood, in support. They ran the shop, they dealt with non-Jewish customers. Very often, women knew the language, Polish, Russian, Ukrainian, much better than the men. By the second half of the 19th century, these women could also read. They start bringing in Tolstoy and Dostoevsky into the house. They bring in foreign culture, foreign values. And the Admor Shalom Dov Ber's diagnosis of the problem was women are the ones who brought it into the home, and they are polluting the minds of the younger generation. So this was his view of women as a kind of a spiritual resource. He thought that's a lost cause. They are dangerous. I say that that is quite historically valid because we had a study by a woman called Iris Posch, a professor at the University of Beersheba, about the reading habits of 19th century Eastern European Jewish women. And she shows very clearly how it is women denied Jewish education, because the system really didn't offer much for them, are the ones who are beginning to turn to European culture much earlier than the men. Women are reading in Russian, in French, in German. They teach themselves German. They know Yiddish. They can easily make the leap to German. They're the ones who are bringing these books home. Also, interestingly, Iris Posch, her study, did not come up with a single reference to a woman reading, even in Yiddish, any Hasidic book. not even the Hasidic hagiographical, not Shivchei Habesh, not one reference. I have a deal with her because she's still working on it. She's now writing another book. I've asked her to let me know if she ever comes across a reference to a woman reading Shivchei Habesh in Yiddish, to please let me know. And about 6 months ago, she sent me the one and only reference she has found so far. This is a man called Baruch Schwartz, who was a teacher, a Hebrew teacher. He became a Zionist, eventually came to Eretz Israel. He died in 1920. He describes his childhood in a small agricultural colony in the Ukraine in 1860, more or less, where he came across a family where the woman was a meyaledet, was a midwife and a herbal healer. And every Shabbat, he says, she and her two daughters would read, and then he has a list of the standard Yiddish repertoire that women did read, Zenarena, Trines, Yiddish translation of some historical books like Yosipon and so on. And then at the end he says, Shivchei Habesht, etc. I don't know how reliable this is. I have a suspicion that this might be what he believed was a standard library of Yiddish works, pious Yiddish works available to women. I can't rely on it. But it is striking that only one such reference. So women were not even reading the Hasidic literature that was becoming available to them in Yiddish translation. Okay, so the Admor Shalom Dovber accuses women of being responsible for polluting young minds with modern secular values, and does not draw the conclusion from it that his son, the Admor Yosef Yitzchak, does for the first time. The Admor Yosef Yitzchak takes the radical step of appealing to women for the first time as guardians of the religious sentiments of the younger generation and calling on them to be mobilized to reinforce it. He starts with a campaign of Taharat HaMishpacha. This is something that he conceived during a visit in 1928-29 to the United States, where he goes to Baltimore, he goes to New York, where he has certain concentrations of his former Hasidim who had emigrated to the United States at the end of the 19th century. And he's appalled by the state of religious observance in these Jewish colonies of emigrants, former Chabad families. And so he begins to send appeals to women in the United States, and eventually when he goes back to Riga, also in Latvia, also sending it to the Soviet Union, where these things are very dangerous, encouraging women. He says, women, you are responsible for it. Set up mikvaot. Talk to the men, get them to support you, but you take the matter to your own hands. And that is his first appeal to women, occurs in a number of letters, statements, kol koe, and it appears as a theme in his mamarim and his sichot as well. More remarkably, and this is something that I rather belittled. I was aware of it, but didn't think this was very significant when I first addressed myself to this some 20 years ago. But my friend and colleague Tali Lowenthal has written about this and has drawn my attention to the importance of this and the scale of it. He, for the first time, and this is really radical, encourages women to study Hasidism. Dach, Divrei Elokim Chaim, to study Hasidic Torah. This was unheard of. He points out in a number of letters he's addressing to the father of a young girl in Riga who apparently is very spiritually hungry and has been asking her father for guidance on what she should read, what she should study to satisfy her spiritual urges. So the father consults the Rebbe. The Rebbe says, and she says, he says, should I encourage this? That's unheard of. The Rebbe says, yes, and recommends particular types of ma'amarim. Interestingly, and in contrast to what Chabad do now as part of the outreach meal, it's not Tanya that he puts before her, which is what normally Chabad would offer to people being first introduced to Chabad. No, it's some relatively recent ma'amarim of his father and some of his own. He also says translate them into Yiddish so that women can read them in Yiddish. And indeed, he himself publishes Sichot in Yiddish. It is claimed that this was partly in order to enable women to read it. I don't know how many of them did read it, but that he had the intention of encouraging women to gain access to Hasidic mystical teachings in Yiddish, to translate them into Yiddish in order that women too would have access to them. More remarkably, he even visits a group of girls in Riga where he stays very briefly just at the last minute before he is smuggled out and goes to New York. There's a group he knows of girls who meet regularly and read Hasidic Ma'amarim, and he comes and visits them, and a transcript in Yiddish of his address to these girls has survived. It seems to be authentic, and was published in the Yiddish Haim in the 1980s in Yiddish. It seems to be authentic, from one of the survivors of the girl, that original girl in Riga who studied Ma'amarim, Hasidic Ma'amarim, and had the one occasion when he actually addressed them at the last minute before he left. He founded also an organization called, his father had founded the yeshiva, the Tmimim. Tomchei Tmimim is the name of the yeshiva, supported of the perfect ones, and the students of the yeshiva are called Tmimim. Now, he founded an association that he called Achei Tmimim, the brothers of the Tmimim. This was an association of laymen. These were not full-time students of the yeshiva, but they were encouraged to meet at regular intervals and study together some of the latest Ma'amarim that were coming out of the Rebbe. And at the same time, he founded, and this is in the 1930s, at the same time, 1938, I think, 37, 38, he finds a counterpart, female counterpart. He calls it, well, Achot HaTmimim. I spoke about this with one or two people earlier on. I think he meant to say Achiot HaTmimim. In other words, the sisters of the Tmimim, as a counterpart to the brothers of the Tmimim. But the name, the tradition in Chabad is to call it the sister in the singular of the Tmimim. And this is an association of girls who would study the same Ma'amarim as the brothers of the Tmimim would be studying, separately but at the same time. In different places, he addresses this to the Chabad community all over the world. How many of them did it, we don't know. And he actually says explicitly that it would give him great pleasure if they could synchronize it so that the boys and the girls would be studying the same Ma'amarim at the same time, even despite time lag, even if some are in America and some are in Russia. So he wanted synchronicity and comparability of the girls and the boys. This is unheard of. Now, as you would know, when he came to the United States, he founded the first association of Neshei Uvnot HaChasidim, the wives and the sisters of the Chasidim, a name which I cherish because I believe that his successor and son-in-law, the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, very significantly changed it. Because for the sixth Lubavitch Admor, Yosef Yitzchak, however radical he was in his approach to women, they still were defined as the wives and the sisters of the Hasidim. Now, when the last Lubavitcher Rebbe takes over this organization and develops it into the what we know it to be today, he changes the name. It's no longer the wives of and the brothers of the Hasidim, but it is the wives and the sisters of Chabad. Neshei Uvnot Chabad, not Neshei Uvnot Hasidei Chabad, and I believe that this is very significant. They are now an active constituency of the movement, without a doubt. I won't spend much time, because I'm running out of time, describing, and quite a lot has been published about this, the enterprises that the last Lubavitcher Rebbe started for women. Perhaps the crowning glory is the institution of the Shlichim and Shlichot that Larry last night referred to. As female clergy, he referred to the Shlichot. I wouldn't go as far as to call them clergy, but they are there, a full partnership, men and women working together. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, that one can detect a certain progression in his conception of the female emissary. In the 1950s and 60s, when the whole thing begins, he still envisaged them as being active amongst largely Orthodox communities. They're being sent out, but to the Orthodox world. And they're working within the kind of security of the Orthodox world. From the 1970s, and particularly the 80s, he sends them out to places that are desert, you know, places of completely secular communities. And the women are going out. He grapples with the idea, kol kvoda bat melech pnima, the traditional phrase, you know, a woman's glory is within the household. And he explicitly says, so long as they behave with the appropriate modesty, then they can go out beyond pnima. They can go chutzah. And their word will be heard in the world at large. Time and again, in addresses specifically to women, because you begin to have the annual conventions of the female shlichot, of the shlichot, of the female emissaries, in which the Rebbe addresses them. I attended one of these fabengen for women at the time of the annual convention of the shlichot. So there is now a fabengen specifically for women, crowded thousands of women from all over the place, and he encourages them to go out by pointing out that women are much better suited for the work of outreach than men. He says women are more intuitive. I mean, he is a fantastic mixture of traditional stereotypes of women that a lot of feminists have rejected. You know, they're much more intuitive. They're more sensitive. They can speak in a way that would not be confrontational, but would bring that goodwill in people and sway them towards where they want to get them much more effectively than men. He time and again stresses that women have a particular skill, and he links it to ancient tradition, you know, the famous Rashi on Beit Yaakov and Bnei Israel. God addressed, I mean, the women were called first, the men second at the time of the Exodus. He uses the Kabbalistic tradition about how the generation of Geula, of the final Geula, will be a Gilgul, a reincarnation of the generation that came out of Egypt. And just as they came out of Egypt, Bizchut Nashim Tzadkaniyot of those days, the righteous women of that day, so the current messianic redemption that is very imminent would be by virtue of the virtuous women of this generation who are nothing but an incarnation of the old. There are lots of appeals to empower women, to strengthen women. But I would like to conclude with the two things that I find the most striking in what he does. Leaving aside the concrete enterprises that he put in place, the organizations, the institutions, the activism that he encouraged among women, I want to focus on two of his sichot, which do what to me is extremely impressive and very telling of the way he perceived the role of women. And I think that there are two contexts for this. One is the messianic context. He certainly is drawing on ancient Kabbalistic traditions whereby the power of the female would increase tremendously as the process of redemption approaches its climax. And Kabbalistically speaking, when the redemption is achieved, the woman, the female, and we are talking about the female aspect of the Godhead, Malchut, the tenth sphere, the lowest one, the one that's nearest to the material world, would rise, would ascend up the sephirotic ladder, and would be Ateret Lerosh Baala. She would sit above the head of her husband, namely the female would rise above to the highest level of the hierarchy of the divine emanations, which is how the Kabbalists envisage the Godhead. So there is a traditional Kabbalistic dynamics of the redemption that empower the female. It is the female within the Godhead, but that has immediate implications about the world below, because the world below is nothing but a reflection of the world above. So the empowerment of the female at the climax of messianic time is an ancient Kabbalistic tradition, and he's clearly drawing on it. And the other context is the traditional, the classical Hasidic one. The centrality of the tzaddik, of the Rebbe, as the intermediary between God and humanity and mankind. It is through the tzaddik that the yearnings, the spiritual yearnings of ordinary people are channeled upwards, and it is through the tzaddik that the divine bounty, the spiritual and the material abundance of goodness that comes from God is channeled downwards onto this world. So the tzaddik is conceived of as an intermediary and a channel. Now, he takes very knowingly two of the most explicit statements of that being the central role of the tzaddik as tzinol. This is a phrase that comes from the book Toldot Yaakov Yosef that was mentioned last night. Jacob Joseph of Polnoy, the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, who preserved for us the biggest collection of statements by the Baal Shem Tov that we have, because, you know, the Baal Shem Tov himself never wrote much. We have a few letters, but no book of teachings. So much of it is preserved by Jacob Joseph of Polnoy. This is by him in the name of the Baal Shem Tov, and it is repeated time and time again. The tzaddik is a tzinol, or sometimes the word shvil is used, evoking certain Talmudic passages, Kol Haolam Inon Izon Ela Bishvil Chanina Bni, the entire world will be fed only Bishvil, for the sake of my son Chanina, playing on the ambiguity, on the double meaning of the word Shvil in Hebrew. Bishvil means for the sake of, but the noun Shvil actually means pathway, channel. So the tzaddik is said to be a Shvil, a channel, or a tino, through which the bounty comes down to earth. He takes this statement and says, woman is the shvil. And he takes another Talmudic passage in which Adam enon izon ela bishvil ishto. There's a passage in which a man brings in corn. He can't actually do anything with it. It is his wife who grinds it, who makes it into bread. And he is sustained for the sake of his wife, by means of his wife, who acts as his shvil, as his channel. He very consciously plays on the classical Hasidic statements about the tzaddik and applies them to woman, which is unheard of, which is astounding. And the other one he does, the other one which he again applies very knowingly, quoting a classical Hasidic text in which the tzaddik is said to be responsible for b'nei chayei u'mezonei, for the material well-being, not just the spiritual well-being of his followers. He provides for children, namely offspring, life, health, and mezonei parnasa, and livelihood. A phrase that comes from Moed Katan, from the Talmud, and is used time and again in Hasidic texts. He applies the same formula, although he doesn't take it from the same text in the Talmud, from Moed Katan, he takes it from the prayer of Yekum Pulkan, where it appears in a slight variation, B'nei chayei u'mezonei berivchei, I think, slightly different. But he's very aware of it, and I think he's quoting from memory, and the two are fused together. And he says, that's what women are. Women are responsible for b'nei, chayei, and mezonei. He applies the same statement that classical Hasidic texts apply to the tzaddik to women. Women are the channel through which divine bounty comes down to earth, which is quite extraordinary. So there is within the doctrines something that is comparable to what is evident in the external kind of world in terms of the institutions, the activism, the appeal, although one must never forget that all this, however radical, and I really do believe that it is revolutionary, there's nothing comparable anywhere in Hasidism that I'm aware of, it is still done within the traditional constraints of traditional division between men and women, the observance of all the regulations about modesty, about appropriate female conduct. There is a very extraordinary combination of radical thinking, sending women out to do extraordinary things that they've never been encouraged to do before, while containing them within the traditional fold in a way that can hardly be blemished. You know, they observe the strictures just as much as anybody else. And that is very characteristic of the revolutionary bend of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, who played very skillfully, I think, with radical revolution and traditionalism together, the one taking the sting out of the other and the combination being extremely potent. I think I'll stop here, and if there are questions, I'll be happy to take them.
That's a good question. Okay, maybe we'll take one or two questions maximum now. And then, because of the snow, I want to get a little back in schedule. Then we'll take more questions for both our speakers afterwards. But okay. Kashi, if you want to come to the microphone that Adam will give you. We'll take two questions now, and then we'll take a 5-minute break, and we'll keep them, you know.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, please. Oh, okay. So we need a microphone.
Hi. Thank you for your wonderful talk. The last two statements that you attributed to the Rebbe, the late Rebbe, where he talks about the woman, he substitutes the woman in terms of the role of the tzaddik and also the spiel for the physical bounty. Did he cite like Torah sources, Kabbalah sources for making that statement? You may have said it and I missed it.
Mm-hmm. He quoted the classical Hasidic texts. He quoted the Noam Elimelech. He quoted Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy. That is to say, texts that were produced in the final decades of the 18th century by the founding fathers of Hasidism. So he's very conscious that he's drawing on the classical Hasidic tradition and subverting it to apply to women. So there are no earlier Kabbalistic texts for this, as far as I'm aware, but there are sources for it in the very beginning of Hasidism, traceable back to the Baal Shem Tov, quoted in the name of the Baal Shem Tov.
So those earlier sources also attributed women in these...
No. They have nothing to do with women. They are exclusively about the tzaddik. This is the extraordinary thing about it. He uses these formulae, which are applied to the most supreme human being, you know, the tzaddik. And he says, any woman is that. The women are that. Women collectively represent just that.
So it's a totally new substitution.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, I thoroughly enjoyed your talk. I apologize, I arrived late. I think that one thing that needs to be addressed, again, I have a certain bias. I come from Hebron. Living in Hebron was the daughter of the Mittler Rebbe, Reb Dov Ber Shneori. Her name was Menucha Rachel. She was married to a man by the name of Yaakov Slonim or Yaakov Kuli. After her husband's demise, she pretty much was ensconced in a bet midrash of her own. She had her own mikveh. And my source for this is her descendant, Azriel Zelig Slonim,
who... I know his memoirs, yes.
And his daughter, Rebbetzin Ralbag, is still alive in Kiryat Yovel. She was my Rebbetzin when I lived in... Her late husband, Rav Ralbag, was the Rav of Shuna, and he was my Rav. Not only that, when prominent European rabbis would visit Eretz Yisrael, such as the Shinover Rebbe, who Rabbi Cheskel Halberstam, who was the son of the Divrei Chaim, he was an extremely powerful rebbe in his own right. The Shinover came to Eretz Yisrael. He visited her, and he stood in her presence. So I think that this is something that needs to be incorporated because there's a lot of empowerment there. And she would be the closest thing to a Hasidic rebbe.
Yeah. Thank you, Bezalel. Yes, there are quite a lot of traditions. Again, this is in the very early 20th century, not before. Early 20th century hagiographical traditions.
This is in the 19th century.
Yeah, but the tradition is told in the 20th century. I mean, they are preserved in 20th century sources. I mean, that doesn't discredit them at all. But the literary sources begin in the 20th century. You wouldn't find a single reference to such women before. I've scoured, you know, I've really searched.
The place you should look at is Sefer Hebron, and you'll find there this memoir of her descendants.
I know, the memoirs of Azriel Zelig Slonim I've used. I mean, they're extremely rich and very valuable, and I have a lot of material that I've drawn from it.
Check it out with his survival.
Yeah, but I have his dates, you know, his lifetime, and it doesn't matter.
I don't believe it's any fabrication.
No, I don't believe either. What I wanted to say, Bezalel, is that I really believe that from the start, Hasidism did have extremely powerful women. They were almost exclusively, as far as we know, related to the households of the great tzaddikim. You know, they were either widows or sisters or daughters or wives, which in a sense you could say is a continuation of an ancient tradition in the Jewish world. You know, we have information already in the classical rabbinic sources. We have information in the Middle Ages about the daughters of the greatest poskim, halachists of their day, you know, who have a certain reputation for halachic expertise, particularly in fields of halacha that relate to women. We do have learned women. We do have powerful women who are consulted. So Hasidism, perhaps not surprisingly, given that it places so much importance on the personality of the leader, the charismatic leader, it would allow the incorporation of female members of his household in this kind of aura of supernatural power and extreme spiritual force that the male Hasidic leaders enjoy to percolate also to the women of their household. We have a lot of such traditions. I genuinely believe that we have that right from the start. What I insisted on, this being recorded for the first time in the 20th century, is that it is nevertheless telling. Hasidic literature does not choose to preserve memory of that until the 20th century. I'm sure that factually there were such women, but they begin to appear on the record only in the 20th century. And there is a change of sensibility in the 20th century that makes this necessary or possible. And that in the 19th century, or even in the late 18th century, such women existed, and I believe they may well have, the sensibility is different, and that is not something one preserves. You know, that is as important to remember, that certain things get forgotten, certain things are regarded worthy of preservation, as that certain things happen or don't happen. So I believe it happens, but I believe that Hasidism chooses to exclude it from its collective memory, until in the 20th century other factors bring it to life, make it more important. And from then on, we have lots of references to Hasidic widows of Hasidic rebbes who conduct themselves as rebbes. We have descriptions of women who hold the tish and say Torah and give brachot, quite a lot of them in Poland, in Galicia, in the Ukraine. The hagiographical tales preserve their memory. None of their alleged teachings have come down to us. We don't know of any teachings that have been preserved. In Chabad, there is an interesting case of Freide, the daughter of the Alter Rebbe, of the founder of Chabad, about whom there is a tradition from the early 20th century in a classic study of the history of Chabad by Chabad Hasid Beit Rabbi Halman. He tells us that Freide was particularly gifted intellectually and was much loved by her father, the Alter Rebbe, and he would teach her his teachings, his Hasidic teachings, privately. And her brother, who eventually became the next leader of Chabad, the Mittele Rebbe, Dov Ber, the Mittele Rebbe, used to plead with her to allow him to come into the room and hide and listen. And he would sometimes prompt her. He would tell her, ask our father about this issue and that issue. And then he would sit there under the table and listen to the father exposing it to his daughter, and he would have the benefit of it. So we have ostensibly a model for the instruction of the daughter in mystical Hasidic teachings by the father. The tradition appears in 1904 when Beit Rabbi is first published. We don't have it before. But it gave rise in the 20th century to the what I now believe is a false attribution of a Kabbalistic Hasidic letter written in a mixture of Hebrew and Yiddish, appeared in several versions several times, ostensibly by Freide, by this learned daughter, to her beloved brother. It was assumed that she was writing it. Yoshua Munshein, who is a very, very knowledgeable and sharp Chabad scholar and Chabadnik himself, and works in the National Library in the manuscript department, he's extremely knowledgeable, and I have a lot of respect for his scholarly output. He, I think, demonstrated that this letter wasn't actually written by Freide, but was written by the man who became eventually the rival for the leadership of Chabad after the death of Shneur Zalman of Ladia, Haon HaLevi of Shtar HaSolya. So, but because there was a tradition about her being a learned daughter, there was an attempt to attribute to her a Kabbalistic Hasidic text. It is about it is a letter that explains why it is not yet the right time to disclose the date of the coming of the Messiah in very sophisticated Kabbalistic terms. What I'm trying to say is that we have no record at all of any Hasidic teachings by a woman, even though we have a lot of tales about Hasidic women who held Tish and delivered Torah. So Hasidism chooses not to preserve the Torah, but it does preserve, in its hagiographical tradition, memory of the existence of some women, and I am fully prepared to believe them. It's just that it's not until the 20th century that we have the first references to their very existence.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll take a 5-minute break for chips and coffee and tea and schmoozing, and we'll see you soon.